Welcome to the Real Family Guys podcast with Jeff Emery and Trey Gibson, the show where education and experience collide to help you go deeper in your parenting. Broadcasting from Abilene, Texas, here are your hosts, Jeff and Trey.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Real Family Guys podcast. This is the show where experience and education collide.
Boom.
To take you deeper in your parenting. The date today is October the 24th, 2014. Our topic is to coach or to parent. That's right. Today, Jeff and I, the entire premise behind this entire thing is, let's talk about how we can be a better parent. How can we take our parenting to that next level? How can we take the skills that we've got that maybe are successful, but go one step further with them? So Jeff has brought to us a topic today to talk about one of the key components to doing all of this stuff is we've got to be good at handling emotions. And frankly, in America, we just typically aren't. And or maybe we can handle two or three emotions, but there's four or five or six. Or maybe we only can identify two or three, four or five, six emotions, and there's a plethora of emotions that we're experiencing. And so emotional competency is a very, very, very big deal, not because our kids just need to learn it, but because so do we. So Jeff has got something together for us today to talk about how do we do emotion coaching with our kids? How do we elicit those responses and teach them? Where does it have to begin? Before we get into that, quick housekeeping. If you guys want to stay notified of all the new episodes that come out here at the Real Family Guys podcast, simple, easy way to do that. Go jump over to the sister station, The Family Podcast Network, and over on the right-hand side, you'll see a cool little box over there. Enter your name and your email address. When you do that, it puts you on a list of people that'll get notifications every time that Jeff and I knock out a new show, as well as the Family Podcast Network, to make sure that you never miss out on that one show if you just could have heard it. It could have changed everything about your week. Don't forget, Jeff and I want to know what's on your mind. What do you have questions about? What are the things that you've been thinking? You know, I wonder what they would say about this. Please feel free to call that in. We have a lot of ways we want to do it. I'm gonna highlight today something different as our primary way I'd like for somebody to do that. I'd love for somebody to get on to thefamilypodcast.com. And if you'll click on the Contact Us button, it'll take you to the page called the Japkin page. That's just a little plugin that we've installed to the webpage that will allow you to record something right over your computer. So, or give us a message. As long as you got a microphone connected to your computer, you can ask us your question. And we would love to answer it. Make sure you let us know which show that you want it to go on, whether it's the Family Podcast Network or the Real Family Guys podcast with Jeff and Trey. You can also email us, Trey Gibson at thefamilypodcastnetwork.com or Jeff at texasfamilyinstitute.org. You can call us 661-PARENT-0. Again, if you're out and about driving around on your phone, you want to leave us that voicemail, 661-PARENT and the number 0. All right, Jeffrey, with all of the housekeeping out of the way today, let's get into our topic. What are we talking about, man?
Well, the title for our topic today is to coach or to parent. And sometimes, you know, we wear different hats as parents. You know, sometimes we are coaches, sometimes we're cheerleaders, sometimes we're teachers, sometimes we're disciplinarians, sometimes we're, you know, the nurturer, sometimes we're the authority. I mean, we wear different hats, right? And as I was scouring the interwebs looking for our next topic, I ran across a blog from the Gottman Relationship blog. And the Gottman Institute is honestly one of my favorite places to go on the internet because it's the repository for what's going on with one of my favorite researchers, John Gottman. And when it comes to family and relationship therapy, in my opinion, John Gottman is one of the preeminent researchers in this field today. He's been doing this for over 30 years. And has had, just publication after publication that validates the research that he's been doing about families and relationship. And primarily, when I look at the Gottman Relationship blog, I'm looking at things for marriages or for couples or things like that. And so I ran across one on Wednesday, October 22nd, that was called Five Strategies for Being a Better Parent. And I was like, ooh, parenting stuff from Gottman. This is great. And so I started reading through it, right? And right at the beginning of this article written by Michael Fulweiler, once again, we'll put this stuff in the show's notes for you on the webpage. Michael Fulweiler wrote this article, Five Strategies for Being a Better Parent. And in the very first paragraph, he references a book that Dr. Gottman wrote called How to Raise an Emotionally Intelligent Child, right? And this kind of goes back to what you mentioned at the intro there, Trey, that we all experience emotions. And in our society today, in my opinion, from my experience, I see a lot of people that we're able to manage our emotions in a way that we can be functional. But whenever, you know, the rubber meets the road and we have emotional distress, we don't really have good strategies in place for being emotionally intelligent ourselves. And we get overwhelmed, we get stressed out. And, you know, and so I see this all the time with people experiencing depression or anxiety or other symptoms of poor emotional management. Yeah. And so I began to think, you know, from a parenting perspective, that makes a whole lot of sense. That no wonder our kids have a lot of difficulties these days, because it's hard to give them what we don't have ourselves, yeah. right? And so I wanted to look at these five strategies for being a better parent, but we needed to go back, just like the author of the article wrote, and just remember, what does it look like to be able to not teach our kids about emotions, not tell them how they ought to feel, but rather coach them so that they know how and they develop the skill to manage their own emotions. And that's what emotion coaching is. And so this is a fantastic article that we're going to start with that's actually hosted on a different website, on Berkeley EDU's website.
Before you get into that, I want to address something real quick. I want to encourage the listeners today or whenever you're listening. That's the beautiful thing about a podcast. Whenever you're listening, it could be right. 6 years from today. You might still be listening to the show. But I really want you guys to blank yourself out in their mindset. A lot of times we walk into this, and a lot of the folks that we get on the show are very very well-versed in emotional stuff. And so I think it's real easy to walk into this and kind of think, yeah, you know, I think I got this. I mean, and I love the way you said it earlier, Jeff. I think we walk into this saying, well, I mean, I'm functioning, and I think we often set ourselves, okay, think about it in terms of culinary art, right? Mm-hmm. When you think about food, you've got your cooks, right? And then you've got your chefs, and there's a very big difference. There's those people that love to cook and do it as a hobby. There's people that, you know, they cook, like, for instance, like, and I'm sorry if I'm negative stereotyping here, but like, you know, lunch ladies and stuff like that. They cook food, but chefs are those ones that have worked food into an art form.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's way beyond. And what we're encouraging is that most of us, and I'm including myself in this, most of us are pretty good cooks when it comes to emotions. What we're talking about is can we get to that point to where we take our emotional competency, that ability to do the things that we say we can do, to that other level where it's an art form for us. So much so that we can even communicate that to someone else, our kids in this case. So I want to encourage you guys to really blank yourself out. I'm having to do it too, because there are areas that I stink with my emotions. I have huge places where I'm not very good at them. So this is very vital stuff, because if we're not careful, if not all of our kids, even just one or two of them can pick up on those bad areas, because they'll struggle just like we will in some of these areas. And they're going to go to the one primary source where they've been taught to learn emotions. And often that's us. And a lot of times they pull our bad habits.
Trey, that was very articulate, very, very well said. So jumping into this idea of emotional coaching, or emotion coaching, with our kids. First of all, these are all points that are drawn out of Dr. Gottman's book called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, which in its own right, if you want to just do some reading on your own, that's a fantastic book, right? But we're gonna kind of condense that into three easy points that are all based on this premise. Okay. The premise is, all feelings are okay.
That's
even
right.
even the worst ones, right?
Yep,
it's okay to feel what you feel. And that goes for adults as well as for kids, right? A lot of times I think that we are conditioned to believe or to think about emotions in terms of there's good feelings and bad feelings.
That's right. Agreed.
Right? And so when I have a feeling that in my mind I've labeled as a bad feeling, then the connection with it is that I'm a bad person for having.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's just not true. Feelings are natural. Feelings are simply an emotional manifestation of a response to some stimulus in our environment. That's all it is, right? Yeah. And when we can look at all of our emotions as a way for us to get some information and I'm feeling humiliated right now. Okay. Humiliation. There's an emotion that I don't know anybody that likes to feel humiliated, right?
Yeah.
And so we think, oh, that's a bad emotion. If I'm humiliated, it must mean that people are looking at me badly, or that I've done something wrong, or that I'm stupid, or that, and you can see the spiral very quickly as we start to think about humiliation. But if we can just learn to say, you know what? I'm feeling a little bit humiliated right now. What's going on? Right? Why am I feeling this way? Okay. So even terrible feelings like jealousy and fear and greed, we can see them as invitations to grow and to understand ourselves better. so that we don't have undesirable emotions. And if we can think of it that way as adults, we can begin to uncondition our kids or recondition them, because they see us handling emotions without labeling them good or bad.
That's right. That's right.
In fact, in my counseling practice, Trey, I often tell people that that a more helpful way to think about our emotions is that there are some emotions that are comfortable.
Yeah.
And some that are uncomfortable.
That's my favorite way. Yep. Agreed. Agreed.
And the thing about it is, when you think about it, that makes a lot of sense, because if I'm having an uncomfortable emotion like jealousy or fear or anger or something like that, there's a physical sensation that goes along with it. Either I'm having an upset stomach, or my hands are trembling, or my heart's racing. You know, it is. It's physically uncomfortable. And so it makes sense, because we like to feel comfortable, that I'm trying to get rid of that feeling as fast as I can, right? And so oftentimes when I'm feeling an uncomfortable emotion, it's because I'm feeling vulnerable or exposed or helpless or powerless, right? And so a lot of times that stuff gets covered up with anger.
Yeah.
Because anger helps us to feel powerful and in control, mm-hmm. and people respond to anger, right? So that's why we see a lot of people who are diagnosed with anger management issues. I wish you could see the air quotes I'm putting behind that anger management, right? When it comes to emotion coaching, I think as adults, we need to step back and rethink how we think about emotions and start to tell ourselves it's okay to feel what we feel. And once we can accept the emotion that we have, then it can validate that, okay, I'm having a feeling, and feelings are not good or bad, so that doesn't make me a bad person, right? And so we can handle it without necessarily having to internalize it and make it personal, right? So really that foundation allows us to do for our kids what is step one in this article from the Berkeley website, is that when we want to help our kids by coaching their emotion, first thing we need to label and we need to validate their feeling, right? Because a lot of times kids have a very limited emotional vocabulary, right? Trey, if you were to ask your kids what they're feeling, now your kids may be an exception, but when you ask a young person how they're feeling, we're going to get basic emotion words like, how are you feeling today? What's a kid likely to say?
Mad, sad, glad, happy.
Exactly. You know, they're not going to tell you that they're mildly irritated, or you know what, I'm having cognitive dissonance, Dad. Okay, all right. Unless you're my kid, which you're weird because you've got a therapist for Dad. But yeah, I mean, they're going to give us really basic emotions, and so sometimes we need to help them label it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, here's a sample conversation of a parent who helps label an emotion that they're witnessing in their kid. If the kid hasn't said it themselves, maybe their behavior is telling it, right? Because a lot of times kids use their behavior to try and express what they're feeling. And if we can see past that behavior and help them label it and then validate that it's okay for them to feel that, that's the foundational level of us being able to help them with their emotions. So I might say to a young lady, Molly, I can see that you're feeling very angry and frustrated. Is there anything else that you're feeling? All right. And so then Molly shouts back at me, I'm so mad at you. All right. Well, it's okay to be mad. You are mad at me, very mad at me. Are you also feeling disappointed because I won't let you, you know, do X, Y, and Z right now? And Molly might say, yes, I want to do that right now. And I can say, wow, you seem really sad, right? Have I told her that it's wrong to feel what she's feeling? No. Have I told her to get over it? Have I told her she needs to calm down? No, I'm simply acknowledging and validating what my child is feeling, right? In fact, I even expanded that a little bit. She started off by saying that she was just mad, but what were some of the other emotions that were there?
Let's see, disappointed. Mm-hmm. We also had sad.
Right. And so as we expand the feelings right there and give our children a larger emotional vocabulary, the easier it is for them to label their emotions in the heat of the moment.
You know, this is so valuable. You know, it's like the color yellow. Let's take the color yellow. When your kid comes out and they finally develop the speech skills that they have to articulate words, they do not look at yellow and say, oh, that's the color yellow. There's nothing genetic that helps associate a set of vocal patterns that match up in the brain with the interpretation of that color in your mind, right? It's the same thing with emotions. They have those feelings that go on inside. Every one of us know that feeling that we get whenever we're angry, frustrated, or sad, like Molly was having in this situation. We all understand that. We all have those feelings. But if those emotions don't get connected with a word, mm-hmm. there's nothing to help bring that in. And communication is one of the major things that separates us out from just about about any other species that's out there is that ability for complex communication and being able to say, here's what I am feeling, here's what I am needing. And so that's what we're doing here, is that we're helping them connect words with the feelings that they're having. So parents will often ask me in emails, they'll say, well, Trey, when do we start doing this? When is old enough to start teaching them these things? The answer is that's going to vary from kid to kid. I tell my parents, start as soon as you can. As long as they're starting to understand basic words, start saying out, oh, you look really frustrated. Is your two-year-old going to understand the word frustrated? Probably not. They're not going to quite connect exactly what's happening there. However, you're starting the vernacular. Now they've heard the word frustrated before. Then they heard mommy say frustrated again whenever we had this experience. And then here was another
one. To understand the word.
That's right. And then eventually, one of these days, they're going to associate, whenever all of this happens, this is the emotion that I have. Mommy and daddy keep saying this word frustrated. And then boom, one of those days, you'll be surprised whenever you're 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, whenever your old finally says, Mom, Dad, I'm really frustrated. Boom. But that's the mentality about it. Start it early. It's incumbent upon us to teach them this stuff because they do not come knowing what an emotion is labeled inherently.
Well, and it's also helpful for us as parents to be able to have a range of emotions so that we can respond appropriately. I mean,
yeah, good point.
If the only way I have to describe feeling rejected or hurt or angry is by I'm mad, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a range of mad. Am I annoyed? Am I irritated? Am I frustrated? Am I ticked off? Am I hacked? Am I pissed? Am I overwhelmed? Am I raging? I mean,
yeah.
When I've got a bigger vocabulary to express those things, I'm going to respond differently to my child if they say they're about to be in a rage than if they say, I'm irritated.
I told you about the research article that I read years ago that they polled how many emotions could the average adult label versus how many the kid. You remember that? You remember that one?
I think you've mentioned it before. What were the results again?
The adults could typically list about 7, but typically mm-hmm. 2 or 3 of them were repetition, so they'd be like angry and mad. They mm-hmm. almost had repetition words. Kids, up until the age of about 13 to 14 and 15, can actually label up to 8 and 9. And yeah. So young kids can actually learn how to label emotions better than we can, because we have a tendency to forget and become redundant in those emotions. And they did this out of, like, I think it was 127 different emotional states that they listed that they had the option of getting points from. And typically it was mad, sad, happy, glad. You see how they would use the repetition right. words like that, and they could only. So isn't that fascinating?
I constantly am amazed at the limited emotional vocabulary that we seem to use. But, if we want to be the best parents we can be for our kids, then we're going to learn this stuff and not only do it for ourselves, but then coach our kids through it as well. So step one is we've got to label and then validate the feelings they're having at that moment, right? And as our kids see that we can handle that and we're not labeling them as good or bad, it's okay for them to feel, and we're not getting frustrated either. So we're also modeling at the same time, right? So we help them label their feelings. We're not internalizing them and getting upset back at them or getting frustrated back with them, right? But sometimes as they're experiencing these emotions, they're also having behaviors that are just unacceptable behaviors.
Real quick, Jeff, before we leave that last one too, let's define what Jeff and I mean when we say validate.
Okay.
The idea behind that is that we're allowing that to be okay. So if a kid comes in and they're raging and they're just totally angry, right? It is an invalidation if I tell them, you need to stop that right now. You need to quit being, right? If I come at them like that, that says what you're doing is an unacceptable, we're going to talk about that here in a minute, unacceptable behavior. But
they associate it with having a feeling that's unacceptable.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So whenever, like with the story that Jeff read a minute ago with Molly, the mom said, you seem sad. That's not – she's not addressing any of the behaviors, any of the stuff that she's doing. If she's upset and angry at mom and she's shouting, I'm so mad at you, right? Well, it may not be okay to yell in your house, but that's not what we care about at this point. What we care about is digging underneath the behavior that we'll talk a little bit in a second here and going straight to that emotion and saying, you seem really upset. You seem frustrated. You seem angry. And letting them know that emotion is okay, and you're not going to get punished for that piece. There's no reason to do that.
Because it's okay to have emotions.
It's okay to have emotions, right.
Yeah, that's the validation piece there, is that emotions are a fact of life. It's what we have.
And great
everybody
way to put
experiences
that.
Them to some degree, right? And so you don't have to feel bad for having a feeling. But what do we do with those feelings? And that's where we start to help them understand that it's okay to feel what you feel, but you still have to choose to behave well, right?
That's right. That's good.
And so at this point, once we've talked them through labeling their feelings and expressing them, right, and validating them, then we have to address the behavior, right? It is so important. And the author, Christine Carter, points this out in step two of this process. Once you've validated their feelings and helped them label them, now we have to move on and talk about setting limits for them so they learn how to behave well, even when they're having uncomfortable emotions, right? And so whatever the rule is, if your kid's yelling at you or screaming in your face or being disrespectful or if they've broken something or if they're having a fit or whatever, whatever the rule is, if you need to take a timeout and cool down, if you need to apologize to make up for things, whatever it is, it's okay to enforce that once you have gotten past the intense emotion, right? So once things have calmed down a little bit, then we can come back and we say, listen, it's okay to feel angry and frustrated. It's okay to feel sad, but it's not okay to call people mean names, okay? So I'm going to set the timer, and you need to go to your room for however long, 10 minutes. And when the timer goes off, you need to apologize. And after that, let's have a snack. And that's it. You don't get upset about it. You don't make them feel bad about it. You just matter-of-factly, well, this is what happened and this is the consequence. So let's experience that. And then we're going to come back and we're going to get back on track for doing what we would be doing anyhow.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I tell you, having a foster kiddo, you know, we've talked about Miss Sweet Tea here several times. And, you know, she comes with a lot of behavioral stuff. So there's a lot of emotions that I don't even think she's even begun to associate words with that are stirring underneath that, you know, underneath the surface. And, I mean, we've had spit, we've had kicks, we've had punches to the face. So far, directed mostly towards Corey and I. And real, let's be straight. Mostly directed towards Corey because she's home all day with us. Right. But we've had, you know, poop, you know, thrown and stuff like that. And we've had some pretty rough stuff here because we're talking textbook. Jeff, you'll appreciate this, textbook reactive attachment type stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, we've had to redefine in our behavior, you know, category here what we define as unacceptable, because this little kiddo gives us a lot of behaviors that, under the premise of all of my previous kids, we would have dropped Thor's hammer. I mean, we're talking ban hammer, boom! You know, we're going to ban these behaviors, right? We would have gone crazy with it. But we can't do that with her with everything, or else we will constantly be getting onto her. And we're holding a rule where we're looking to attend to one thing. For every one thing that we get onto her for, we're trying to find those 10 things that she's getting right. And she makes that a struggle. She makes us really have to work for what seems like very base things. So we've had to push what we find acceptable. But the good thing about this, Jeff, is that it's caused me to reevaluate some of the things that I got upset with my kids before.
Oh, yeah.
And behaviors that I banned from them, like if they came in and got upset and started stomping their feet. And heck no, little kiddo, that ain't gonna fly. I really would say that to my kids. And I've reevaluated so many of those things. And I had to ask myself, why did I care so much about this? Now that I've got like shoes whizzing past my head, why did I care about them stomping
about
on a floor?
Stomping.
They're not big enough to break the floor. They weren't doing anything to actually destroy anybody's property. They weren't doing anything to hurt their own person. Why did I care so much about them getting frustrated enough to stomp like that? Here's what my answer is. I've done some self-evaluation. Here's what I think it all comes back to. It's fear. They scares me. When I see my kids act like that, it scares me. And so
you're not controlling them.
That's right. That's it. That's exactly what I've discovered, is that right then in that moment, I've discovered, oh, crap, this scares me. I don't like feeling scared about something my kid's doing, so I'm going to assert my control back over them.
Oh, but you're jumping ahead to that parental agenda stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll leave that alone. So anyway, that's what this reminds me of, is that you really need to stop and take a look at what behaviors really are unacceptable, and you need to evaluate what those ones that aren't acceptable, why. For us in our household, we now have kind of a rule system. We actually pull it directly from the United States Constitution, but life, liberty, and property. And so is it hurting? Is it something that is hurting someone else's life? That can be, you know, wanting to live without being afraid of having something hit them in the face. I mean, that can be a life. But then also, is it going to kill somebody else? That's a no-no in our house. Does it affect somebody else's ability to make a choice for themselves? Is somebody trying to control or manipulate another kid? That's an area where it's unacceptable. And then third, we do property. Is it damaging somebody else's property? If it's the own kid breaking their own toy, we might encourage them not to do that because they may want that toy later. But we don't tell them not to do that. But we say if it's somebody else's property, or if they throw their toy against our wall, that's our property now, and we're crossing those lines. But if it doesn't fit those three, we really evaluate, is it really that unacceptable? Or is this just something we need to see as, okay, they're not necessarily getting out in the best way. We don't want to go to a job and then stomp around because we didn't get the pay raise we wanted, right? We want to unlearn that behavior eventually, but is it really a big enough deal for me to step in?
Okay. So whatever your method is for dealing with the bad behavior, it's okay to have your methods, but you need to be consistent with it, and you need to be is this okay to say dispassionate about it? I mean,
sure,
you're not doing
yeah.
it because you're trying to be mean. You're not trying to – it's just this is the consequence that we've set up, and hopefully it's something that the entire family has had some input in that it hasn't just been a
– yeah.
I mean, lately, my kids are a little bit older now, but one of the things that we've been trying to do a little bit more is when we talk about the changes that are going to be made, Amelia and I have already discussed them, and we know what we want the outcome to be. But when we talk to the kids about them, we're not telling them this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
We tell them this is the change we'd like to see. How do you guys feel about it? And
yeah,
if you don't like what we've offered, come up with something better. I mean, let's discuss this. And so everyone has a voice in the process. So that when the consequence does happen, well, okay, but we talked about this already and you agreed to this, so this is what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, good. I like that.
So dealing with that bad behavior, step two in the process, after you've validated their feelings and helped them label them, right, then you have to – whatever the consequence for the bad behavior is. But that's where a lot of us stop, Trey. My experience has been that, you know, even the best parents sometimes will stop there because the next part is a little bit more time consuming. It takes a little bit more effort. Step three in emotional coaching is you got to help your kid problem solve. And it can't happen in the moment. You've got to wait until you calm down and you're kind of looking back on the situation. But chances are – there's some deeper digging that the behavior goes beyond what was happening in that moment. And it goes back to other little things that happened throughout the day, maybe even a week before, right? That they've been feeling, right? And so, in the example that we talked about earlier where the mom was talking to the daughter, Molly, the mom will sit down and she'll ask, you know, hey, today was really rough. Did anything else happen today at school that's also making you feel bad? And at that point, Molly starts talking about how she had to sit at the table by herself because her teacher called her too disruptive during reading or something like that, where she had to be segregated or you know, push off to the side. Well, you know, when you've got a kid that connects with everyone else socially, that's a punishment right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I can understand how that could help a person to feel sad or lonely or isolated, right? And maybe even embarrassed being singled out in school, right? And so all those things drain you emotionally. And so you even have like some hunger and some exhaustion after you experience those things. And so it's understandable that when kid gets home, kid starts taking it out at the safest person that she can think of, which is mom, right? Which is why she started having a meltdown, okay? And so as you're problem solving with them, you're finding out what else is going on, but you don't tell them how they ought to feel about things, right? Because that makes them distrust what they were feeling, right? And honestly, it might have felt good to yell at somebody. know? It might have felt when I was feeling, you know, out of control and powerless, to be able to yell at my mom, man, that can feel good sometimes, right? And so all we're doing at this point is helping them get in touch with their emotions and labeling and validating more of those feelings, right? And then the last part of this step is we got to say, all right, so that wasn't very helpful. Next time we're feeling something like that, what's a different way that we can do something differently, right? And this is where it becomes really hard not to tell our kids what we think they ought to do, right? Because my experience has been at the beginning of this process, when you first start doing it, you're going to get a lot of, I don't know,
yeah.
I don't know, I don't know. And that's really frustrating for parents. <You're> like, come on, kid, you got to come up with
no,
something.
No, it's not.
And so when you get that I don't know stuff, you know, you might feel like, okay, well, here's what you should do, right? But the more that we try to give our kids these terrific and bossy ideas, the worse off we are, because research shows that people are more likely to actually try solutions if they come from themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Right? That's
exactly, and so we really need to work at helping our kids brainstorm one or two possible options that, you know, next time instead of getting really upset, take a time out or take the dog on a walk or sit down and read a book or listen to a song, right? And whatever it is that they come up with, as long as it doesn't break or violate one of those other things like Trey was talking about before, if it doesn't hurt somebody else or it's not going to break something, let them try it. It may not be – you may not think it's going to work, but you know, if it works for them and it's not hurting anything, why not?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And so there it is. That's the basics of emotion coaching, is label their emotion, deal with the behavior, and then problem solve. And when you can do that on a consistent basis with your kids, you've now set yourself up for being able to implement some of these five strategies we're going to talk about in just a minute. But I want to transition from this point to the next. And before I do, Trey, I just want to give you the opportunity, anything you want to add to the problem solving stuff?
Yeah, yeah. While you're prepping to set us up for our next one here, you know, one of the things I want to encourage you guys to be is listen to what your kids say works for them. A while back, I was talking with my kids and we were brainstorming a better way to handle some issues going on at the home. I was working with Anna. And I asked her, I said, what would work for you to help, you know, to help keep this from going the same direction next time? And she goes, well, you know, Dad, it would help me if I could play Minecraft for 5 minutes. And so my first thought was, yeah, heck yeah, like we're going to let that happen. We're not going to let you go play video games after you've had one of these. But I, Corey, luckily, thank God for my wife. She came in and she goes, Trey, what does it matter? That's one of our common phrases that we use around the house. What does it matter? Why is that a big deal? What does it matter? And, I thought, let's give this a whirl. So we established that. And sure enough, I mean, she does great when she can just get, and she honors it. She sets the clock and she watches it for 5 minutes and it brings her down and she comes back out a whole new kid ready to rock and roll. So I'm not saying let your kids go play video games. There are certain, sometimes kids, yes, will try to take advantage of that. I've had my kids do that kind of thing in the past, but don't poo-poo on an idea that maybe seems slightly out of the box, and we don't mean that in the Arbinger, you know, language we normally talk about, but something that's not traditional thinking. You know, don't necessarily poo on those, you know, without, you know, giving them a chance, because sometimes what may seem like they're trying to fish really may be a fairly appropriate strategy from what they know about themselves emotionally. And then sometimes you might have to say, okay, listen, what about whenever we're out and about at a restaurant and we don't have access to Minecraft? What then? What can we do there? So you might have to keep them thinking a little bit. But again, don't rule it out just because it seems weird.
Well, and that's actually a really good dovetail into this next section, Trey. So you set me up for the first step that we're going to talk about on the next website that we all have listed in the show notes from the Gottman Relationship blog by Michael Fulweiler, the five strategies for being a better parent. He starts out with having to step one is you've got to ignore your parental agenda, right? And I think that's kind of what you were talking about, is that as a parent, I have in my head, based on my lifetime of experience, I have in my head what my kid ought to do, right?
Sure, yeah.
And I've also been watching my kid for, you know, however many years. I mean, if they're 9 years old, I've been watching for 9 years. If they're, you know, 13, I've been around for 13. Their entire lives, I've been watching them. And he cautions us to avoid not only having your agenda, but also avoid trying to be too global, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. when we correct our kids, we start without realizing it, putting little critiques in there about behaviors, right?
Yeah, this is
like,
good.
Like if your kid tends to be overly sensitive about something, right? And so a situation comes up to where they got teased at school, and honestly, you may feel like they're making too big a deal of it and they need to learn to just get over it, right? But you're trying to be empathetic and you're trying, but in the back of your head, you're sitting here saying, yeah, you're just going to have to learn some things you just got to get over it. And so that's kind of the script that's running in your head. And unless you can ignore that script, I guarantee the words are going to come out of your mouth. Well, you know, son, kid, daughter, whoever it is, have you thought about maybe just trying to not focus, maybe just kind of get over it, and they're going to hear it and it's going to fill in this critique and they're going to feel like they're not really listening to me.
Yeah.
Right. And sure. So they're going to disregard anything else because we're not focusing just on the specific incident. We're bringing in every other time they've been upset about something. And so it's going to sound like we're doing this global critique because we got this parental agenda in our head of my kid's too sensitive. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. If you want to retranslate this into a different word, I prefer parental agenda, but flip it around. What Gottman's saying here is don't go fix your kids. Yeah. Don't fix your kids. Now, that doesn't mean that we sit complacently by and let our kids go through the same pattern of something that they're doing over and over and over and it's not getting any better. But the idea we're talking about here is instead of fixing our kids, teach our kids how to look for things they want to fix and then show them how, right?
Oh, yeah.
The reason this is so hard to separate out, well, what does it matter if I'm trying to help my kid grow and give them advice? Most of the time, at least when I do it, and I have a sneaking suspicion it's when most folks in this society do it, whenever we're trying to fix our kids, we're not really focused on their objectives and their
That's
needs.
Right.
We're focused on ours. Mm-hmm. I don't want to look like a bad parent. I don't want everybody looking at me when we're in Walmart and they're screaming. I don't want everybody thinking that I'm like the abusive foster parent who does this or that, right? I mean, it's typically about us. And I'm not saying in all cases, but typically it's about us. But if we're really thinking about what we want for our kids, we acknowledge that we are finite beings. I'm going to die one day. Hopefully, my kids are going to live on past me. What are they going to do if daddy's not here to walk them through one of these things, right? So the idea, the goal of effective parenting, as we always talk about, is we need to teach our kids how to know themselves, be emotionally, right, like we've been talking about in this show. They need to be emotionally competent, and then they need to know how to look at those behaviors that surface in their lives because of those emotions and say, I don't like this. This isn't working for me. It's not getting me where I want to be. What do I need to do to work on this?
Absolutely. So that's the first powerful step here that that Michael Fulwiler is suggesting as far as the strategy for being a better parent. And ironically, it sounds counterintuitive, right? To be a better parent, you need to ignore your parental agenda, right? but like Trey said, this is the difference between trying to help your child learn how to fix themselves versus you trying to fix them and mold them into what you think that they're going to be, right?
Does anybody like that? I'm asking the audience. I mean, have you ever had somebody who's tried to fix you, and they kept giving you their ideas and thoughts of how you should be, and oh my gosh, I hate that. I think just about everybody hates that.
And we're very resistant to it.
Oh my gosh, we are so resistant to it.
So to be a better parent, you need to be aware that we all have a parental agenda, right? And we need to be able to listen empathetically, engage in the moment about what's going on. And now there's going to be exceptions. There's going to be other situations that call for a different approach. But in general, when we correct our kids, we need to listen more about their perspective and help them develop their perspective, which is kind of what step two is. He says in step two, you need to empower your children by giving choices and respecting wishes, right? Mm. Now, this is a really tough thing to do because sometimes in the growing process, the developmental process that kids go through, they're going to push the envelope that goes outside of what the family value system is, right? And when they choose to ignore those family standards, the things that we've tried to teach them to put there for their protection, some of those lessons, some of the things they learn are painful, right?
Yeah.
But the benefit of letting them experience to express a preference about something and to learn, wow, I didn't make a very good choice there, is that it will help them build self-esteem, right? It will help them to understand I can make my own decisions, and even if I make a bad decision, I can learn from it, right? Yeah. And so the next time your kid makes a request, even if it's a small, silly, or trivial request, don't think of it as a battle of wills, like they're trying to get their way, or and you have to. It's that power struggle and contest, right? The result of them being able to make a choice, even if it turns out to have a painful outcome, can benefit them because it helps them develop a better sense of self, and it helps them to learn to trust their decision-making ability because they're refining it and honing it in safe little ways, because you allow them to make choices and then you respect their wishes, even if you disagree with them.
You know, I love this one because a lot of times parents will struggle with this. And let me rephrase that. A lot of times as a parent, I struggle with this. And because the mentality is, well, what if it's an unacceptable social behavior, something that you're not supposed to be doing? I'm not going to give my kid a choice to do that, right? See, that's rooted in this belief system that is completely, at least I will argue till I am dead, a belief system that's completely erroneous, completely wrong. And this is idea that we control our kids. We do not control our kids. Yeah, well, you haven't seen my kids, right? When I ask him to stand up, that dude stands up and gives me a full salute, right? That may be. That's not you controlling the behavior. You may influence that behavior, whether it be through positive relationship and they want to please you, or maybe it's even unhealthy they want to please you, or maybe they're just flat out afraid to not please you, and so they do these things. But fundamentally, the choice lies in your kids' hands, from itty bitty all the way up until now. So when we say that we want to empower our child, I think a lot of time we get this idea that like we're going to give them power. That if we empower our kids, we're giving them the power that they have. No, let me rephrase that. Jeff may disagree. I'm not sure how you believe in all this stuff. From the mentality of Trey, we don't control anything. So when we empower our kids, we're not giving them power. We're just reminding them of that power. And so whenever we give kids choices and we respect the wishes that they do, we're acknowledging, number one, I don't control you. Number two, you are allowed to make these choices in your life. If we're doing it right, we're also telling them, here could be the consequences of having these choices. Now, you may proceed to choose what you want to do. Now, I'm not saying that you put a shotgun and a pistol down in front of your five-year-old and say you have a choice to not touch these. We need to do safe. We need to do safe, right? We need to keep them safe and all that other good stuff. But the whole point is that we are showing our kids the choices that are completely at their disposal and hopefully teaching them the ones to make that will not have detrimental consequences, at least not life-threatening. So that way, when they have those consequences, they can learn from it.
Well, and I think it circles back to the bullet point on this step, which is to empower your children by giving them choices. Yeah. When we do not give our children choices, when we don't, within that safe range, give them, you know, do you want the yellow pajamas or the blue pajamas? When we don't help them develop the choices on a trivial level, then we are actually robbing them of the opportunity to develop that decision-making process,
right? That's right, yeah.
And so by giving them choices, even in small things, we are helping to empower them to believe that, one, they do have control over themselves, and two, that they have a responsibility to make decisions. And I can't tell you the number of people, Trey, that I see that have grown up with in the helicopter generation with parents meaning well, wanting to help their kids do better. And so they just make all the choices for them. And then they get to be, you know, these college age students and young adults who they've never developed, believing that they have the ability to make good choices for themselves.
Yeah, that's right. That's good.
So we need to empower our kids by giving them choices and respecting their wishes, right? Okay, so the third technique that that he shares is that we need to share in our child's dreams and fantasies, okay? I am a huge fan of the human brain. To the extent that we understand it, I think that we do a pretty good job, but there's so much that we don't understand, and how our creativity and our imagination works is consistently fascinating to me, right? Because it can be pretty bizarre, person to person, right? But understanding that our kids' dreams are important to them, and even developmentally, some of their dreams and things that they daydream and fantasize about are more real to them developmentally, because that's how their brain is wired at that point, that when they express that stuff to us, this technique is a great way to get on their emotional level, right? Mm-hmm. It may sound wild, kooky, crazy to you, or your adult brain may automatically dismiss it as a flight of fancy and something that is just, you know, too silly to be considered right now, right? But if you can get on that level and help our children express the desires, even that are beyond the realm of possibility, right? We need to remember as adults that all of their wishes and emotions are acceptable. Their behaviors are not necessarily, right? But yeah. But you can dream about anything, right? One of the ways that I've I was able to adopt in talking to my kids about some cultural myths like Santa Claus, right? I've gone back and forth with people about whether or not you should tell your kids about Santa, or whether you should perpetuate this myth that there's an all-seeing entity that knows when you're sleeping and knows when you're awake and knows if you're good or bad and is going to bring you toys or, you know. You know, that's up to people's individual preference, right? But for us, one of the things that happened when we had our oldest child start to question about the existence of a Santa Claus, right? Well, I've seen a lot of people get in a tizzy about it, right? But the thing about it is that it's fun to imagine and it's fun to pretend. And part of the spirit of the holiday season for us as a family was that we get to do wonderful things, generous things for other people. And part of it is the Santa Claus myth. But when it became time for them to start asking questions, we didn't try to lie to them. We didn't try to perpetuate it. We just said, you know, it's fun to pretend, isn't it? It's fun to believe in this stuff, not because I have a literal belief that there's a guy that lives in the North Pole and, you know, all the stuff that comes along with that. But part of the holiday season, it's fun to pretend. It's fun for us as a family to dress. Some people don't like Halloween. I love getting dressed up and wearing superhero costumes, or even, you know, we had a zombie Halloween party a week or so ago. It's fun to pretend and engage in the sense of the mysterious, and that's an important thing on a kid level. So sharing in their dreams and fantasies and being willing to engage them on that level is a way for us to be a parent that gets their kid, and for our kids to feel like we get them is a powerful, powerful relationship connector.
Well, you know, and I want to go a different avenue with the ideas of fantasies. I think it's easy to think of, like, you know, mom, dad, I want to know how to fly. You know, that's a positive fantasy. But let's talk about fantasies as well that maybe are considered more negative and emotionally for kids. Like, let's say we've got a divorce in the family. Which is a reality today. Sure. And they say, I sure do wish you and daddy were still together, right? That's a fantasy. And I think for us, because of the emotional components that are behind it between spouses and separation and hurt and all that other stuff, you know, we want to resist that. We want to fight that. Oh, I don't want to talk about that. Well, that's just not the way it is, kid.
And
I'm sorry.
We want to crush their dream because doesn't sound real to us.
That's right. And so, you know, we have a tendency to poo on that. But this, what we're talking about here is helping kids explore that. And it's okay to ask them, what do you think that might look like? And it's okay to explore that fantasy. It may hurt you a little bit to go through that. It may hurt you even worse to hear a kid who desires to have that. And in your mind, you know it can't be that way, you know. And so, but being ready to walk with them through those is so valuable, and it's so powerful. And it's no fun when we have to say, I sure do wish that Peepaw was still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like going down those, because those uncomfortable emotions, like Jeff very eloquently worded at the start of this, those uncomfortable emotions are no fun, especially when we see our babies. We see our babies hurting because of this. But being willing to walk with them in those, what do you think that'd be like if Peepaw, what do you think Peepaw would say if he was sitting right here? Being willing to step into that with him and let him go through that, it's very, very, very healing.
And connecting with those emotions, once again, we do a really bad job of when we feel an emotion that we've labeled as uncomfortable or a quote unquote a bad emotion. Mm-hmm. I don't like to talk about it that way, but that's how it gets labeled. Then we tend to get rid of it, and we don't understand that sometimes visiting those emotions, I don't want to live there. I mean,
That's a great way to put it.
There is a negative spot for getting stuck in those places, which leads to depression and bad self-talk and some other things like that. But
yes.
But visiting those emotions
right.
is not necessarily a bad thing, right?
That's good, Jeff. I like that.
As you were talking about that, Trey, it actually sparked something in me, and I don't want to take a huge tangent in here, but from personal experience, having to explore with my kids when we've had some bad moments with diabetes, you know, we've talked about this before. Two of my kids have type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disorder. That, you know, they didn't do anything wrong to get it. It just happened to them, right? And yet it affects us in such a pervasive way in our family. I've had the discussion with my kids sometimes, you know, Daddy, why did God give me diabetes? Or why did, I mean, the way they phrase it, you know, why did this happen to me? And wouldn't it be nice if we could just do, and, you know, for me as a parent, I've learned to lock those feelings away because they're not productive, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't like to explore them. They don't feel good because I feel powerless as a parent. I can't, it's incurable. There's not a cure for this disease right now. And so I've locked all that stuff away and I don't deal with it very often. But for my kids to want to talk about it and explore it, I need to be able to be uncomfortable for a little bit and to be able to talk to them about this. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Or, hey, I don't have an answer for that, but what if? And to use what if language, it's such a powerful thing. I might have to afterwards go and cry a little bit to get some of it out of my system, because it's, like you said, Trey, it is so disempowering to see your babies hurting and not be able to do anything about it. But yeah, this is one of those things. I would love for my children to hold on to the dream that within their lifetime, this is going to be something that they don't have to deal with anymore.
Wow, that is amazing. Powerful.
All right, so let's get through 4 and 5 here so we can wrap this up. I love this next one. A strategy for being a great parent to your kid is to read children's literature together. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember working with a family one time who had a child who was, I think, 2 years old, and we were talking about the things that were in his room. And I said, well, you know, do you have some of these books? These are some of my children's favorite ones that they like to read, you know, Goodnight Moon and, you know, some of the Berenstain Bears books and things like that. And they're like, oh, well, he's got some toys. He didn't have any books. And I almost fell out of my chair, and I was like, oh, you know, do you read together? Well, you know, I'm not much of a reader, and I'm like, wow.
What?
I don't have time to cite all the research that's out there. That
you are a bad person. I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing.
Important it is to give your children, they may grow up not being great readers, right? But the foundation that you give them, from everything from building vocabulary to talking about feelings to illustrate how people do things to helping them learn, how to take another perspective, age-appropriate books provide a way for parents to talk about subjects that may be hard to address, right? Yeah. I mean, you might be able to do that with TV programs and movies or anything, but books do something, and they engage the brain and the imagination in ways that TV and audio don't, right? Yeah. And reading aloud helps children have a better sense that if we're doing it as a family, that we're all kind of participating in this storytelling. And so they might feel a greater investment in that narrative. But reading literature together has been a powerful thing for my family. And I can't emphasize enough, even if you're not a very good reader, get books on tape or get books that are easy to read or just get down on your kids' level and encourage them to be good readers, because it is so, so important.
And, you know, this is so good because there's so many novels or books that are out there that you can help use your kids. I mean, we're you know, we think about exploring like the fun, you know, the caterpillar goes out and eats a whole bunch of stuff and makes friends shows, and that's good. Those are good. But there's so many books out there that help you explore those uncomfortable stuff too. Shel Silverstein is a great He's a great author that really he writes a more, I want to call it dark, a more dark sense of things that go on with it, but it's good. You know, the stuff that he writes is fantastic, and it can help you kind of explore some of the emotional components. There's books out there about that talk directly about death that are written for young kids, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and letting our kids read those books and not just the Where's Waldo type stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love Where's Waldo. But we can really immerse our kids in some of that negative stuff and let them see that other people experience these too, not just the Gibson family or the Jeff. Why am I doing this?
The Emery family.
Well, I'm looking at your name on Skype right here. The Emery family deal with it. Everybody deals with these. And anyway, I love books. Books are so good. And if we're conscientious about it, we can find books out there that get into that really uncomfortable stuff we don't like talking about as well.
I think that that's a great point to bring up, Trey, and that connects it back to what we're talking about being these emotional coaches for our kids, is that there are going to be topics that we don't have very good words for. Well, guess what?
That's good.
There are thousands of writers out there who have done it in a better way than I'll ever be able to, right? And you mentioned Shel Silverstein. He's one of my favorites. But even somebody as simple as Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss's writings are profound.
Yeah,
and they address everything from acceptance and inclusion to love to decision making to, I mean, it's really remarkable stuff when you think about his storytelling and the characters that he's created. So even Dr. Seuss, which, you know, is on a pretty basic reading level, can lead to some discussions about how to be the people that we want our kids to grow into being.
One more thing to tag on to that, too, especially as kids get older, a thing that comes very important to them is music. Music in and of itself is literature. Lyrics are a piece of literature, and a lot of the stuff that goes into the music can be very very good for them to run through, because you can connect with people on a very emotional level with music. And don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean if your kid's listening to Screamo Goth or something like that, that doesn't mean they're going to go grab a gun and start killing people at schools or anything like that. And so don't overread into it. But taking a part of listening to a kid's music can also be kind of a piece of this, especially as they get older.
Absolutely. All right. The last suggestion from Mr. Fulweiler here is that we shouldn't try to impose our solution on our children's problems.
Ooh, that's good.
Now, I love this one, not only because it's good, but if you bring it up to the adult level, we all go, well, yeah, you know. I mean, when you think about one of the quickest ways to get into a fight with somebody is to try to tell them what they ought to be
that's
doing.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know? Yeah. That's and sage. So, that's sage right there, Jeff.
If we're trying to say, hey, emotion coaching, this sounds like a good thing, we're going to try and do that, you're going to sabotage your emotional coaching as a parent if you try to tell them what they ought to do, right? And so while we may get frustrated that our kids don't want to take this unsolicited advice that we're giving them, you know, especially considering if they would just, I mean, I know what they need, right? But that's not the way that children learn. Right. This goes back to that whole idea that people don't care what you know until they know that you care.
Yeah, that's good.
Right? And so to propose a solution before you've empathized with them and gone through the emotions with them, it's like trying to build the frame of a house before you've laid that firm foundation. Right.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's probably a really great metaphor to talk about the whole emotional coaching experience, is that it's about laying that firm foundation, and everything else is about building on it.
Yeah.
So emotions and what we talk about on a regular basis here on the Real Family Guys podcast is they're the foundation for a healthy relationship. And once you've got that foundation laid, then you can start doing those things correcting our kids and training our kids and modeling for them and other things. But they've got to know that we're connected with them on an emotional level to build that relationship.
Yeah, letting your kids come up with their own ideas and what they're going to do is so, so valuable. And I'll tell you guys this. There's only one way that I have ever done something that might be categorized as soliciting advice that typically works 9 times out of 10 with my kids and the people around me, and that's whenever I do a story. That's an allegorical, but I mean, I say allegorical. What I mean is a literal story. Whenever I give them experiences that I've had in my past, so if my kid comes up to me and said, "Dad, this happened, you know, today at Sunday school," you know, I remember when I was a kid, and then I fill out the story about what happened, and I talk about where I messed up, and then where I fixed it. Those will often work, especially if they understand I'm not directing this towards them. I'm not telling them they should do this. I'm just telling them that this is how it worked out for me. It turned out, you know, I find it interesting that what did Jesus preach the most through was through parables, through stories. He didn't come up and say, you know, you should go do this. He told stories, and I think stories have a tendency to kind of enter in. You know, we firewall our heart a lot of times towards advice because, you know, whatever it is that we, you know, whatever it is that causes that, whether we don't want to seem incompetent or whatever. But the stories of how we went through something and failed, and or we went through something and actually had a success, is kind of that back door to people's hearts, because if they understand, I'm just telling you some experiences that I've had, you can take it or leave it, versus here's what I think you should do. Something about that is disarming. It doesn't work every time. I don't want y'all to hear me say that's your elixir. Just pour that over you and your kids' relationship and tell them stories about what happened to you, and boom, now they'll make good choices. No, but it can sometimes get that back door opened up for them.
Well, one of the things that that I've also found on the internet, Trey, is that five strategies for being the best podcaster that you can be is that that you keep one of the strategies is that you keep your podcast within a reasonable amount of time. And as I'm looking at the time that we're bumping up against here, I want to give us a pat on the back because this is actually one of the times we've actually kind of stayed within the frame that we've given ourselves.
Boom, baby.
And presented, you know, several different things, but we do want to let our listeners know that we appreciate you. We appreciate that you're out there and that you're telling other people about us. And we hope that you will share not only this this podcast about emotion coaching and strategies for being a better parent, but any of the stuff that we've done, not only on the Real Family Guys podcast, but also on the Sister Network, the Family Podcast Network. There's amazing stuff out there. And not just here. Some of these sites that we're constantly referring to, the Gottman blog and Aha Parenting and some of the others that we put out there before, we encourage you, the more time that you invest into strategies and learning how to be the parent that your kid deserves and the parent that you want to be, the more of a blessing you can be to your kids. So we appreciate you being here today, and we hope that you will join us next Friday when we once again will bring you another fantastic podcast from the Real Family Guys.
We'll see you guys next week.